Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'll be your host, Alex Linder, and you can find everything that we do at vnnforum.com. Today on Thermopylae Day, the second annual, April 21st, 2015, we make a cake, a white cake with white frosting and three blood red candles to symbolize the courage of the Greeks who lost their lives, who sacrificed their lives at Thermopylae in Greece to keep Europe free of invaders. And it's a day to soberly reflect on the courage of our ancestors and the duties that we owe to our posterity. And it's also the second day of the turkey hunting season in northeastern Missouri, well, actually all Missouri, and one of the hunters I host got one, so we got about a 16-pound Jake, not huge, about an average size sort of a turkey, and we're going to eat it. And the way that you eat a turkey is you cut off the wings and you cut off the drumsticks and you crock them, because they're otherwise they're pretty tough meat, and then you cook the rest like a chicken. You cook it at 450 after coating it with salt, whatever spices you like, and sticking them under the skin. You cook it very hot at 450 and crushing it down as much as you can. You can cook it on a bed of potatoes, carrots, other vegetables, and put just a little bit of water on the bottom of a big pan and cook it very hot, and you'll get it as tender as it can be, cooked as quickly as it can be, and that's how you do the wild turkey. Now, what we're going to do today is something a little bit different. Since it is a holiday, a white holiday, Thermopylae Day, I'm going to read to you a story, and we're going to learn a little bit about the background of Hector Hugh Munroe, or the short story writer known as Saki. Hector Hugh Munroe, H-E-C-T-O-R-H-U-G-H-M-U-N-R-O, an interesting and unusual spelling. He was a British fellow, wrote a lot of really excellent short stories. I got the Complete Stories of Saki, a cheap Wordsworth Classics book. I believe I picked this up in a retail outlet store somewhere in the Deer Valley or Park City around there in Utah. I wasn't skiing, but they have a lot of outlet malls, and I went there years and years ago. Well, I went there with some female relatives who were buying stuff, but I went to the bookstore and I got this, and I've enjoyed reading it multiple times. It's one of my top 500 books. Because the guy's use of language and what we're going to do, it does, perhaps you should read purely for pleasure, but if you haven't, I'll read you through. This is the way that someone smart who enjoys literature and what it teaches you about human psychology, as well as the excellent use of words to bring enjoyment and to spread enlightenment and education. You know more and you appreciate more. And that's why you read literature. Not to prove you're better than other people or be competitive. You read it for enjoyment. That's why you put good strings of words together. Yeah, sure. Okay, you understand things better. That's great. But that's merely functional. You read for the greatness of the work if you're reading literature. You read for some real psychological insight if you're reading drama from someone like Dostoevsky. Something beyond a self-help book. Tell me about life, something I don't know. But you also read, you know, in the utilitarian sense, to see words used, and in the aesthetic sense, to see them used brilliantly. Now let's do a little of, and works are not a product of forces. That's Marxist reductive crudism. Works are the product of authors. Now granted, those authors come from times and places, so they are going to somewhat reflect their time and place, because that's what they know about, but fiction is also a creation of the mind. Might be something in there that doesn't exist anywhere else except this person's mind, and see if they can make it real to you. Okay, and now I'm going to read you the introduction. This will give us a little biographical background. It's nice to know a little bit about the writer. Not absolutely necessary, but if you're in like an AP English class or in a college class, they're going to tell you about the background of the author, and you know, leftists will make a big deal over it. It's a white male or someone else. It doesn't really matter who it is, because the quality is either there in the words or it isn't. It's just like playing chess or something else. It doesn't matter what your ethnic background is. If you have the goods and you can prove it on the table, it doesn't matter how many degrees you have or what your ethnic background is. But so happens that pretty much all the greatest writers were white. Not all were male, most were male, but and then there's great writers of other races occasionally, but basically you could read all the great white stuff and you'd certainly never be done with that in your lifetime. For myself, it's a continuing lifelong attempt to read the best stuff. I'm reading Moby Dick, which I had somehow never gotten around to. I never had a copy of it, is the reason I haven't read it, and never read it in school, never had it assigned. So let's dig into Hector Human Row Saki, The Complete Stories of Saki. There's a very interesting sort of a picture of an English dandy or a fop or kind of the Oscar Wilde set without the implication of queer, but maybe with it a little bit. I'm not sure if some of his characters are queer, but they're very sort of, think of that David Hyde Pierce character in Frasier. They're a little bit along that lines. That's kind of how the English were back then. Very concerned with the figure that they're cutting. These are high-end aristocratic gentlemen, but a lot of them are kind of spivs, people who are kind of chancers making it on the kind of getting by and pulling little intrigues and little tricks, but it's very social and it's very upper end. Introduction. Let's see who wrote this introduction. I'm not even sure. It's just a introduction. There is no greater compliment than to be paid than to the right kind of friend than to hand him sake without comment. So you see sake and you think it's like Japanese or something, but it's actually a British fellow named Munro. This remark by Christopher Morley in 1930 is as true today as when it was made. So to some extent, An Introduction to Saki's Short Stories, and this is a very brief introduction, novels and plays is superfluous. The best introduction is to read them. It matters little where one starts, but perhaps the quickest way to acquire a taste for Saki's sardonic humor, that's mocking humor. Again, we'll look at the good vocabulary words we come up with. If you're an upper middle class and you're taking vocabulary lessons in your AP class, sardonic would be one of the words. I've always had a hard time separating it from sarcasm. Sarcasm means literally like ripped flesh, right? But sardonic is more mordant or more, it's kind of like that mocking, snarky tone, kind of like snark in a way. Perhaps the quickest way to acquire a taste for Saki's sardonic humor is to read of the activities of the outrageous Reginald. That's one of the main figures that appears in many of his stories. Or of the refined cruelty of the Epicene, Clovis Sangrail. We're in the introduction, we've already have two good vocabulary words, sardonic, well, even three, superfluous. Epicene, what does that mean? Having the characteristics of both sexes. Right, kind of like androgynous, but a slightly different. I'm not sure I could articulate the difference though, without looking it up. The androgynous would be having of men and women. Epicene is about the same, with the implication of being kind of effete, I think. Whereas androgynous is kind of like it doesn't carry the connotation of being effete so much, or even the denotation. It means androgynous is literally like confused between man and woman or having characteristics of both, but epicene is kind of like almost connotations of sybaritism or sybaritic or sort of now I may be wrong about this. This is what I'm thinking without looking it up, but epicene kind of in an unmanly, even just a slight, like we're describing a perfume, undertone of vaguely sexually deviant, vaguely soft, or ingratiatingly queer. Hints of officiousness and unctuousness, weakness, slyness, maybe a little creep in. I'm being like the character in Roald Dahl, another one we've done the fiction of, describing the perfume in one of his short stories in Switch Bitch. Anyway, perhaps the quickest way to acquire a taste for Saki's sardonic humor is to read of the activities of the outrageous Reginald, or of the refined cruelty of the epicene Clovis Sangrail. Alas, one will never know the answer to Reginald's ambiguous question, "What did the Caspian see?" But at the end of the unrest cure, the reader is left with a frisson. That's what Chris Matthews feels when he thinks about Obama, frisson running up his leg. A frisson of pleasure at Clovis's political incorrectitude. Saki's Short Stories of Urbane Malice. are like a fine dessert wine. They should be sipped and savored slowly. So intense are they to read that to read them at one sitting may induce a kind of literary dyspepsia. What's dyspepsia? Well, you know what a dysphemism is, right? The opposite of a euphemism, the term to sugarcoat something. This would be a term to make something even worse than it is, a dysphemism. You don't see dysphemism used as much as euphemism, do you? So what would dyspeptic be? What would eupeptic be? Dyspeptic means like bad indigestion, sort of a sickness or a feeling of turbulence in the stomach, a feeling of ungoodness. So eupeptic would be, I felt eupeptic after eating the snails, for they added some missing magnesium that had been causing my lower calves to cramp up of a night. That's just a sentence I concocted to use it. You wouldn't actually hear anyone use it like that. They would use it differently, but that is a valid use. It's certainly a construction no one else ever put together, I'm sure. But you like to use words like this if you're trying to achieve a sort of a comic or ironic effect a lot of times, or a high-to-low effect, per Leslie Nielsen. The serious intoning of something in a deep bass or at least baritone voice in order to imply a profundity that the saps and the doers and the long-faced Christian folk to mock that sort of mentality with something higher that is conscious of the, if not futility, the inherent funniness of everything. To me, that's a white attitude, and we must do literary stuff now and then, because people will think that all pornography, that all irony, that all wit, that all dirtiness is un-Aryan and is inherently Jewish. That is absolutely wrong. Whites do everything, and they do everything best. And so we read from the whites who are the best at the wittiest, the most ironical, the most pleasure-producing in what they write, even if they're immoral or amoral, as the type of characters he's writing about tend to be. It's a little bit like P.G. Woodhouse is another one, spelled Woodhouse, pronounced Woodhouse, but maybe goes even a little bit nastier. Pretty much just as good, though. Three of the best things to come out of England: Dahl, Woodhouse, and Saki, in terms of writing in the last 100, 150 years. I'll read that again. Saki's stories of urbane malice are like a fine dessert wine. They should be sipped and savored slowly, so intense are they that to read them at one sitting may induce a kind of literary dyspepsia. Like if you ate too much, as he's saying, of something really rich. However, they are so beautifully crafted that one can return to them again and again with enhanced pleasure. That's true. They do bear rereading. Perhaps one of the most remarkable aspects of Saki's writing is his sympathy with the oppressed, in particular with children. He recognizes the terrible hegemony that adults wield over the young, who, however intelligent or articulate, are essentially powerless. Without a doubt, this stems from the author's own unhappy childhood. It is best seen in Shredni Vashtar, like Sri Racha, Shredni Vashtar, which is one of the finest stories in the English language. Saki was himself something of an outsider for his suppressed homosexuality, and that comes through in the cattiness in his work. His suppressed homosexuality lent him an intellectual fastidiousness that despised cant and hypocrisy. This is at its most cutting in Tobermory, the sly story of a cat that learns to speak. Other animals are used to expose the foibles and frailties of upper-class Edwardian society with devastating effect. Gabriel Ernest and Laura being two of the most chilling. With the exception of The East Wing, a story discovered in 1946, all Saki short stories are included in this volume. And this is a volume of some 600 pages, very small, tiny little type. Print it is, not PDF. I'm holding it in my hand as I'm reading it. Saki also wrote two novels, The Unbearable Bassington, 1912, and When William Came, 1913, which are included here, as well as The Westminster Alice, see below. Saki wrote three short plays which are accomplished but lack the concentrated and vitriolic humor of the stories. Now here's just a brief bio of him. Saki was the pseudonym of Hector Hugh Monroe. He was born in Burma. I remember that was a British colony. In 1870, youngest of three children. His mother died when he was an infant, so he, his brother, and sister were raised in Devon by two aunts, most of whose deeply unpleasant characteristics appear in the stories. When he was 23, he joined the military police in Burma, just the way George Orwell would do a generation later, following the military traditions of his family. However, recurrent attacks of malaria enforced his resignation a year later, and, after recuperating in England, he joined the Westminster Gazette in 1896 as a political sketchwriter. Around the time of Peter Finley Dunne in Chicago in America, if you'll think, right before 20 years, a little before Mencken was coming of age in America. So he joined the paper in 1896, the Westminster Gazette. These satires were later published as the Westminster Alice and the Not-So Stories. I guess that's opposed to Rudyard Kipling's The Just-So Stories. A serious historical work, The Rise of the Russian Empire, was published in 1900. Monroe became Balkan correspondent of the Tory Morning Post in 1902. Think of Donald Day coming over from the Chicago Tribune to serve over there. He kind of had a similar job to both Donald Day and to George Orwell. And between then and 1908, he covered Russia, Poland, and Paris as well. Reginald originally published in the Westminster Gazette. Reginald originally published in the Westminster Gazette, appeared in book form in 1904, followed by Reginald in Russia, 1910. The Chronicles of Clovis, 1911. Beasts and Super Beasts, 1914. With the other stories published posthumously. He enlisted in the ranks in 1914 at the outbreak of the First World War, although he was well over the age limit. By 1916, he was a lance sergeant in the 22nd Royal Fusiliers. He was killed by a sniper on the dark morning of 14th November 1916. His last words before being shot were, "Put that bloody cigarette out." So there you go. That's the tragedy of World War I. It kills off a lot of the literary artists of the time. A lot of British poets and writers were killed. Just an incredible, terrible loss of blood from which some think Europe could never recover. Although Monroe's pseudonym Saki is described by the Oxford Companion to English Literature as being of unknown origin, Ethel Monroe points out that her brother chose the name of the cupbearer in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, a favorite book. And I have not read the Rubaiyat, so anyway, that's still an interesting piece. So that's good. And let's now read his first story, Reginald, and see where it goes. And so his first story that we're going to read is called Reginald, and this is an introduction to one of his main characters as well. Now I'm going to read and we'll talk about the words. I'm not going to read it just purely straight through. We'll stop and make little notes for kind of verbal annotations as we see fit, as we have done so far. Reginald is the name of this story. It's not long. I did it. I should have known better. I persuaded Reginald to go to the McKillops garden party against his will. We all make mistakes occasionally. They know you're here and they'll think it's so funny if you don't go, and I particularly want to be in with Mrs. McKillop just now. Notice that I want to be in with her. This is how the English are, you know, the little intrigues and thinking and the figure you cut and how you fit in and where you are in people's personal popularity polls and the good that they can do you if you're in their good graces versus being a persona non grata out of their good graces. I particularly want to be in with Mrs. McKillop just now. I know you want one of her smoked Persian kittens as a prospective wife for Wumples. Or a husband, is it? Reginald has a magnificent scorn for details other than sartorial, another vocabulary word referring to matters of dress, right? And notice the magnificent scorn for details reminiscent of G. Rodney Dangerfield in Caddyshack, where he goes, "That kangaroo stole my ball." So he's saying that the one, and that you, it's kind of semi-sublimated faggotry, but it's still high level. He says, you want a mate for your kitten. He's Reginald doesn't even know what sex his kitten is what he's saying. Magnificent scorn for details other than sartorial, other than in matters of dress. He could care less about anything. This is very much the gay 90s, the fin de siècle, the end of the art for art's sake, the wearing of the green carnation, the stuff associated with wild. It's more of that attitude, the abhorrence of natural stuff and the preference for the artificial. Reginald, it's nothing of the kind, only I'm sure Mrs. MacKillop would be pleased if I brought you. Young men of your brilliant attractions are rather at a premium at her garden parties. Should be at a premium in heaven, remarked Reginald complacently. There will be very few of you there, if that is what you mean, but seriously, there won't be any great strain upon your powers of endurance. I promise you that you shan't have to play croquet or talk to the archdeacon's wife or do anything that is likely to bring on physical prostration. You can just wear your sweetest clothes and a moderately amiable expression and eat chocolate creams with the appetite of a blasé parrot. Nothing more is demanded of you. You can feel the homo cattiness in this, but it's not actually catty, but you see how easily cattiness would spring from that attitude. It's just funny. It's funny. It's literary amusement. I mean, I suppose a lot of people don't like it, but I think it's great. Reginald shut his eyes. There will be the exhaustingly up-to-date young women who will ask me if I have seen the sand toy. A less progressive grade who will yearn to hear about the Diamond Jubilee. That's that massive celebration they had in Britain, celebrating all the latest British Empire and the latest science that was, I forget when it was. It was kind of like they had in Chicago in like 1893, like a World's Fair. This is the kind of thing they used to do back then. I think they still do that. But anyway, you get the concern with being au courant, being fashionable trends. And when this plays into politics, this is where you get it. They become these modern liberals, and they're above race snobbery, and then they move on, become eventually the Puritans. Always got to be cooler than thou, always got to be holier than thou, always have to hear of everything before everyone else does, so that you're always the coolest person on your street and at your garden party. In Britain, they would have a season. You know, they'd have different balls on the higher end, and they would all go to these different parties thrown by different people. Then they'd go out to the country and stay out in the country for, you know, a week or two at these gigantic castles and such. And this is the world that's covered by the writers about the elite. A less progressive grade who will yearn to hear about the Diamond Jubilee, the historic event, not the horse. A little bit of a joke there. With a little encouragement, they will inquire if I saw the Allies march into Paris. Why are women so fond of raking up the past? They're as bad as tailors, who invariably remember what you owe them for a suit long after you've ceased to wear it. Now that's quite in the Oscar Wildean vein there. I'm dying as I live, beyond my means, you know. I'll order lunch for 1 o'clock, and that will give you 2.5 hours to dress in. See, dress taking longer than a woman to dress. That's another sign of a male faggotry there. Reginald puckered his brow into a tortured frown, and I knew that my point was gained. He was debating what tie would go with which waistcoat, but still refinement, and extreme refinement, even if it's in pursuit of a perversion or perverse pleasure, is still yet again white. Whites make the best perverts, like Eminem makes the best nigger. Like I Jew the Jew better than the Jew Jews us. Like this faggot does the best at coordinating his tie with his waistcoat. You see, whites are always found at the top of any particular thing you care to name, and that goes for the negative as well as the positive. Even then, I had my misgivings. Line break as we move to a new scene. During the drive to the MacKillops, Reginald was possessed with a great peace, which was not wholly to be accounted for by the fact that he had inveigled. Good little word, inveigled. That means to obtain by, you know, verbally. It's kind of like an older style. It's not rare, but less used word to mean socially engineered. Through your charms of personality. Let's say you show up for your driver's test and your eye lenses have shifted since you got your last license 6 or 7 years ago, and you can't really read the line. It's kind of 45-55. Maybe you talk the woman into giving you a second or a third chance. And if you inveigle her, you do it right, you social engineer, she lets you get through without needing new glasses. See how that works? That's what inveigled. Inveigled, a good word. Good word to have at your disposal. During the drive to the MacKillops, Reginald was possessed with a great peace, which was not wholly to be accounted for by the fact that he had inveigled his feet into shoes a size too small for them. Just the smaller the feet are, that's a more effeminate characteristic. If a man is trying to make his feet look smaller, then that's a proxy for his sexual inclination, you can tell. I misgave more than ever. There again, there's an interesting use of, you've heard of misgivings, right? Here's a use of the actual verb, I misgave, which I've never used, but I can recognize it, but it's not in my active vocabulary because I wouldn't use it like that. But look, you can use it like that. This extraordinarily accomplished writer uses it like that, thus expanding, enlarging the scope of our possible operation. This is why you read great literature in part. If you want to learn how to write better, you see how other people, unusual uses of normal words and the use of unusual words that is nevertheless justified. They're not using it in a Mike Tysonian sense. They understand what they're saying. There's a specific reason that they're choosing one term instead of another. A lot of times it may be simply for the number of syllables the line possesses in order to convey the proper musical quality of the text, which I should be bringing out. If I know how to appreciate it, I should be able to intone it with my voice so that you receive also the pleasure of the musicality of the writing. Writing can be seen as indeed a form of music, which is also capable of encoding with the music sense. And music can tell you things emotionally, like if you listen to Guns N' Roses, you can feel certain things. But writing can crystallize feel streams into specific ideas. I misgave more than ever. And having once launched Reginald onto the MacKillops lawn, think of like a country estate and they're having an outdoors party. It's the season. It's the nice time of year, say. Or maybe the season is the balls they have in the winter and then the rest is when they go up country to their landed estates. But one of those two things. I misgave more than ever, and having once launched Reginald onto the MacKillops lawn, I established him near a seductive dish of marron glacé. Now, I don't even know what that is, but I would say it's like maroons, glazed maroons or something, some kind of cookie with, I'm pretty sure glacé is icing. And listen again to the language. I established him near a seductive dish. Don't you like how that is? I established him here. I misgave more than ever. He launches him into the party. He establishes a beachhead near the delicious cookies. And as far from the archdeacon's wife as possible. So being queer, they're very concerned with appearances and trying to avoid people that they don't, that might bring up things that aren't nice or that they don't want to talk about. As far from the archdeacon's wife as possible, as I drifted away to a diplomatic distance, I heard with painful distinctness the eldest Mockby girl asking him if he had seen Santoy. Again, figure cutting, talking about what's all around. Have you seen the latest? Have you heard the latest? Have you heard of Echo and the Bunnymen? I always use Echo and the Bunnymen because A, it's inherently funny, and B, that was kind of the typical type of band that would have been thought very cool to have heard of and uncool not to have heard of. And I was uncool because I hadn't heard of it when I was in college in the 1980s. So it must have been 10 minutes later, not more. I had been having quite an enjoyable chat with my hostess and had promised to lend her The Eternal City and my recipe for rabbit mayonnaise. Now notice the combination of the high and low. The Eternal City, who is something about Rome, and then the rabbit mayonnaise. And was just about to offer a kind home for her third Persian kitten. So indeed, he is sucking up to this woman, the hostess, in order to get her a smoky Persian kitten, when I perceived out of the corner of my eye that Reginald was not where I had left him, and that the Marone's glacés were untasted. So he thought he had established Reginald by the Marone's glacés, but Reginald, being a human with volition, wandered off somewhere else. Where did he go? At the same moment, I became aware that old Colonel Mendoza was essaying to tell his classic story of how he introduced golf into India, and that Reginald was in dangerous proximity. So he's afraid that Reginald's going to start making fun of this old Blighty, as they call him, you know, the British who served abroad in the Empire, and start mocking some of his story or picking little flaws in it the way that homosexuals are apt to do. And other people being... Homosexuals see the world as a bunch of... They are refined aesthetes, and the rest of the world is crude plotters. It's somewhat similar to the way that at least homos in the closet tend to see it that way. When they come out of the closet, they tend to become as plebeian as others, but when they're in the closet, they tend to see themselves as refined, and if they're of a particular mind, they might enjoy sort of unsublimating their cattiness into remarks of it. Filled with asperity or just sort of a viciousness, but it can be quite funny, and that's what we're going for. That's what he's going for here. So this old Mendoza is about to tell his classic story of how he introduced golf to India, and Reginald is going to is luring around. The other guy's been trying to keep him away. He doesn't want him to socially upset these. He doesn't want to get kicked out of the party before he's obtained his ends, which could be a Persian kitten and whatever else. There are occasions when Reginald is caviar to the colonel. When I was in Pune in 76. My dear colonel, purred Reginald, fancy admitting such a thing. Such a giveaway for one's age. I wouldn't admit to being on this planet in 76. Reginald, in his wildest lapses into veracity, never admits to being more than 22. So again, we see like a woman, he's denying and underestimating his age. Again, that's an effeminate characteristic, right? Not a masculine one. And also notice the wildest lapses into veracity. See, the opposite of the normal phrasing. So you have to think about it. Remember that the average mind reads to be confirmed. It's bothered. It's bothered by departures from customary formulae. Women in particular not only feel comfortable, they delight. They take a positive delight in cliche. So that which is masculine is the farthest from that, enjoying the new and the deviate. It's sexual, you know. Men can be wasted because sperm is easily found, so men are free to try to discover new and better ways, and if most of them get wasted in the process, nevertheless, they'll eventually, some of them will hit on something that's better for the species as a whole, whereas women are more careful, cautious, and conformist. So that even, and this reflects through the whole of life, in space exploration just as much as in departures from customary verbal formulae, which is I borrow from Paul Fussell in Class. You see, talking about how much the middle class loves the seriocomic exaggeration of the multiplication of excessive syllabification because they falsely believe that confers dignity and weight on something when in fact it merely reflects it fatuousness, precisely in the model of it's the verbal equivalent of Leslie Nielsen and that ponderous tone that is equivalent to the tumbling rocks. If you've ever been to Universal Studios, they have a tour there out in Hollywood, and they have one part of that tour I remember, I think I went on that back in the 70s or something because we used to live out there. They have the giant boulders coming down a hill at you like they're going to crush you, but of course the boulders, although they look perfectly like boulders, are simply lightweight. And that's the same effect as Leslie Nielsen and that from high to low, that very deep, ponderous voice that is saying silliness. Sonorous, but super silly. And I personally love that effect. And you try to achieve that in your writing also. And to me, it's one of the more delicious effects. I try to do it. It's almost my default vein. It might even be. But here we see wildest lapses into veracity, so that the nature of the homo is concealing things. So he's given to concealing his age and everything else. And sometimes only it's crude, rude, and reductivist. But to lapse lapse into veracity. Ever seen it described? It's always described the other way as a lapse into falsehood. But he lapses into veracity. He accidentally tells the truth. And this is not just a homosexual thing. It's kind of a British cultural thing. And it explains some of the attraction to liberalism, or at least why they're so good at it. They get into that thing of, we can't ever call things what they are, and somehow it becomes the elite thing to do to not call things by their real name. And when that goes into politics, you get something that feeds very naturally into the Jews' attempt to cover up the results of their promulgated policies of white genocide, that is, the hush crimes that are caused by this policy, and quite deliberately so, en route to white genocide, are covered up, and the British cultural elite preference for not calling things what they are kicks in. You don't ever see any lapses into veracity in the media. You see a continual cover-up, just the way Reginald is covering up his age here. Now, when I was at Pumna in 76, my dear Colonel, purred Reginald, fancy admitting such a thing. Such a giveaway for one's age. I wouldn't admit to being on this planet in 76. I wouldn't admit to being on this planet in 76. Reginald, in his wildest lapses into veracity, never admits to being more than 22. The Colonel went to the color of a fig that has attained great ripeness. And Reginald, ignoring my efforts to intercept him, glided away to another part of the lawn. I found him a few minutes later happily engaged in teaching the youngest rampage boy the approved theory of mixing absinthe within full earshot of his mother. Mrs. Rampage occupies a prominent place in local temperance movements. I don't think I need to explain that part. As soon as I had broken up this unpromising tête-à-tête, French for a head-to-head discussion, one-on-one discussion, and settled Reginald where he could watch the croquet players losing their tempers, I wandered off to find my hostess and renew the kitten negotiations at the point where they had been interrupted. I did not succeed in running her down at once, and eventually it was Mrs. McKillop who sought me out, and her conversation was not of kittens. Your cousin is discussing Zaza with the archdeacon's wife. At least he is discussing. She is ordering her carriage. She spoke in the dry, staccato tone of one who repeats a French exercise. Now, staccato is a term taken from music. It's the opposite of legato. Legato means smooth and flowing and mellifluous. Staccato means chop, 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 chop. Have you ever heard Béla Bartók, a Hungarian composer? I think he might be a Jew, or he might not. I used to play that when I played the piano. I didn't enjoy playing the piano, but I played a lot of Béla Bartók, and it's basically annoying, not very pleasant music. It's like pinecone. But I meant, what are those animals with the quills? A porcupine. It kind of has that poke, 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 poke. That's what staccato is. Versus legato is smooth. So when he's saying she's speaking staccato, she's angry, and she is squeezing her vocal cords to be very irritated. She is ordering her carriage. She's getting snitty because of what Reginald is doing. She spoke in the dry staccato. Now listen to how the writer describes this. She spoke in a dry staccato tone of one who repeats a French exercise, and I knew that as far as Millie McKillop was concerned, Wumples was devoted to a lifelong celibacy. If you don't mind, I said hurriedly, I think we'd like our carriage ordered too, and I made a forced march in the direction of the croquet ground. I found everyone talking nervously and feverishly of the weather and the war in South Africa, except Reginald, who was reclining in a comfortable chair with the dreamy, faraway look that a volcano might wear just after it had desolated entire villages. So his work there is done. The archdeacon's wife was buttoning up her gloves with a concentrated deliberation that was fearful to behold. I shall have to treble my subscription to her cheerful Sunday evenings fund before I dare set foot in her house again. And notice, this is the kind of white lowest common denominator you have, as opposed to the, in America today, 100 years after this is written, you know, you have problems like whites are attacked by feral blacks, raped and murdered, but here, in classic England, where you don't have any minorities, it's all about people's interplay, the interplay of delicate feelings among people. It's a much higher lowest common denominator that's possible where it's whites in a white context. At that particular moment, the croquet players finished their game, which had been going on without a symptom of finality during the whole afternoon. Why, I ask, should it have stopped so precisely? Why, I ask, should it have stopped precisely when a counter-attraction was so necessary? Everyone seemed to drift toward the area of disturbance, which the chairs of the Archdeacon's wife and Reginald formed the storm. Of which the chairs of the Archdeacon's wife and Reginald formed the storm center. Conversation flagged, and there settled upon the company that expectant hush that precedes the dawn, when your neighbors don't happen to keep poultry. What did the Caspian see? Asked Reginald with appalling suddenness. There were symptoms of a stampede. The Archdeacon's wife looked at me. Kipling, or someone who has described somewhere the look of a foundered camel, gives when the caravan moves on and leaves it. Kipling somewhere has described the look of a foundered camel gives when the caravan moves on and leaves it to its fate. The peptonized reproach in the good lady's eyes, and I don't even know what that means, the peptonized reproach in the good lady's eyes, brought the passage vividly to my mind. I played my last card. Reginald, it's getting late and a sea mist is coming on. I knew that the elaborate curl over his right eyebrow was not guaranteed to survive a sea mist. Again, the effeminate, excessive caring about a curl of his hair and how it looks. He doesn't want to be seen at less than his best. Never, never again will I take you to a garden party. Never. You behaved abominably. What did the Caspian see? A shade of genuine regret for misused opportunities passed over Reginald's face. After all, he said, I believe an apricot tie would have gone better with the lilac waistcoat. And that's the end of the story. And so we'll do other stories by Saki, but I think that look how much learning and how much finesse there is in one simple little story from this guy. So much you can learn, so much you can observe, can really pull stuff apart and look at it while you appreciate it, because understanding and analyzing, I don't think are, at least to me, they're not wholly different things the way some people think they are. But then again, I really observe, I love order, I love analysis, but I also love, per Oscar Wilde, sublimating the analysis to the entire impression of the thing, and I enjoy the subtle, it's like some classical music. There's a lot of different little things you can listen to, and it's more nutritious. It's more packed. It's like a steak versus, you know, a hot dog, or real mahogany or real redwood versus some cheap plywood. There's more substance to it. There's more nutrition to it. There's more things that you can replenish yourself with and learn from in it. It's denser. And finally, to conclude, I'd say it's just plain whiter. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and enjoy your Thermopylae day. Reflect on the need for courage in all of our lives to sustain, preserve, and extend our race, regain some of what we've lost, and gain new stuff. And I will be back with you again real, real soon.